Hi there. When a coin is tossed up in the air, as it twirls over and over, there's no way of saying which side it will land on, heads or tails. The two sides of destiny, the difference between choice and fate, the difference between victory and defeat. And it's in that distinction between choice and fate that one man's fate seems to have turned quite inexplicably in the last week. I'm talking about Ravichandran Ashwin, who had played just two one-day games for India in the last 6 years. We all thought his one-day career was over, but he's back, out of the blue, into the World Cup scheme of things, with two solid performances against Australia. And his story is much like this Heads and Tails podcast, which has also been on a long break. Not as long as his. It's been 3 weeks since our last episode, but we too are back with a bang. As the World Cup countdown heats up, with teams still tinkering around with the combinations and reacquainting themselves with the OG Pyjama Cricket format, we are back. I am Nitin Sundar, and if I'm the Amir Sohail of this podcasting partnership, then my core icon tour, Abhishek Chopra, surely is the Saeed Anwar of this podcast. Chopsy, welcome back. How are you doing?
I am good, Nitin. Thank you so much. And it's great to be back at a time when the cricket world is heating up nice and proper. And the OG format, which we all got to love as a kid, we got an overdose of it in the 90s, is back. And I don't know what will come of it after this World Cup is over, but we'll worry about that later. For now, it's time to take in one of the most favorite formats that's there in cricket. It's ignored and it's treated like an orphan at times, but it's beautiful nonetheless for me.
Absolutely. And the lead up to this World Cup has been unusual and unlike any World Cup in the past, because like I was mentioning, it's like everyone is getting reacquainted to this format, which has largely been forgotten. Teams suddenly realizing that they need different combinations. What works in Test cricket, what works in T20 cricket, doesn't quite work in one-dayers. So every team struggling with landing on their final squads and final 11s, and the tinkering going, right down to the wire. The Indian team, for instance, I think the final deadline for the squads is not yet out. So we are expecting a few more changes to be made to that final squad. But it's unclear what India's best 11 is. And I don't think they will know what their best 11 is going into the World Cup, because they have about 15 players who are ready to put their hands up and play. And it's the same for multiple other teams who seem to be trying out various combinations, and lots of teams are not playing their first choice players in the lead up to the World Cup as well. So plenty of tinkering going around. Have you seen a World Cup with this kind of, completely ad hoc kind of preparation as far as all the teams are concerned?
No, I think by the time, we had the last World Cup, teams were still invested in this format quite heavily. And you had a pretty set template for how, ODI matches and ODI innings would go. England, of course, revolutionized it to a great extent with their completely gung-ho approach in the lead-up to 2019. And true to form, they ended up winning that tournament. But this time, it feels quite different. With the T20 World Cup happening once in 2 years, that seems to have taken the center stage, so to speak. And the ODI World Cup is perhaps going to be a journey of discovery for fans and cricketers alike. It's one thing to watch bits and pieces of Test cricket over a complete day, when you could go run an errand and nothing much would happen. But in ODI cricket, to sit in front of the TV for 8, 9, 10 hours and watch the whole game is like a whole different experience. And here's our chance to, get familiarized with it again.
It's the Australian team touring India and playing one-day cricket. It's a World Cup year. It's 2023, but it's equally true of 1996. That favorite year that Chops and I like to keep going back to. You're going back to our favorite tournament, and I take the liberty to say it's our favorite tournament and not just mine, the Titan Cup Tri-Series that happened in 1996, in the afterglow of the One Day World Cup in 1996, the warm afterglow, I must say, as India continues to reinforce its newfound love for the one-day game. And we had Australia and South Africa completing the triangle as a long series that went on for weeks together, with each team playing the other three times before having a single final to decide the winner was underway. South Africa were dominating the series like nobody's business. They thrashed both India and Australia three times on the bounce, so six wins to them. India and Australia were then fighting for the other spot in the final. India defeated Australia and Bangalore in a close game, which we spoke about in a past episode of this very podcast. The second game between India and Australia was washed out at Cuttack, and hence it boiled down to this final league stage game between them at Mohali, where India and Australia played the first ODI in 2023, a few days back. It was back again in Mohali in 1996, with a spot in the final at stake as India ran into Australia. Chops, am I right in saying this is our favorite tri-series tournament or our favorite one-day tournament? That was not a World Cup.
Absolutely. I mean, the Titan Cup has such beautiful, happy memories, and happy memories across multiple matches, not just, one or two. And this Mohali match was complete, total, utter madness. And it turned around so many times that even the mention of it brings back such happy memories of, a child really lost in the match and, topsing and turving and turning around with it. And when the two teams clashed in this tournament at Mohali, as you mentioned, it was a very, very important game. Only one spot in the final was up for grabs. And Australia, somehow decided to win the toss and bowl first, which was a bit of a shocker, because you didn't do that on a flat pitch on a beautiful track like Mohali. But I think there were two reasons for doing that. One was obviously the dew factor, especially in North India. The other was the Bangalore partnership that you mentioned. Maybe that left a few scars in the Australians' mind. And they knew that even if it came down to the Indian lower order and Jawagal Srinath and Anil Kumble, they could take India home from any situation.
Even that Bangalore win, which was witnessed by the elders, the mother and grandmother or grand aunt, I forget now, of Anil Kumble's, was a very close win and a very famous win for India, because we defeated Australia very rarely in those years. And so there was pressure was very much on India as they went to bat.
It had already become a bit of a trend, either at this time or perhaps even a little bit earlier, that the press was hankering for Tendulkar to play his natural game. Those of us who saw him in the early part of the 90s really knew how explosive he could be. But by this time, especially after becoming the captain, this was, of course, his first ODI series as captain of India. He had already sort of hunkered down a little bit and seemed to be playing well within himself, perhaps taking on the extra responsibility of making sure that he stays till the end and, puts up a good score for India all by himself. Whereas perhaps the need of the hour, with him being the one stable guy in the opening partnership situation, was for him to go out all guns blazing and play his natural game, and then the others could perhaps follow. Here in this match in Mohali, oh man, he scored some 62 of 61 balls, I think. The strike rate isn't much to write home about if you talk in respect to today's era. But some of the shot making in that match on that true pitch with amazing bounce ball coming onto the bat was just phenomenal. And it was of all sorts of lengths, and it was of all sorts of lines. And wherever the three Australian pacers would bowl, Paul Rifle, Glenn McGrath and Jason Gillespie, who was a surprise inclusion in place of Damien Fleming, who was perhaps more suited to this kind of a pitch, the ball would just fly off his bat, and he was really, seeming to be good for a century, but it wasn't to be. Sparkling innings nonetheless. On the other hand, you had Navjot Singh Sidhu, who you would remember had gone to England, come back from England after a fight. And the one thing that hadn't changed in between all of that was his running between the wickets. And He was a horrid runner, and if he wouldn't get run out himself, he would be sure to get his partner run out, especially in this phase. I think in this tournament or little phase itself, he gets run out a few times. And here again, he goes for a completely suicidal run out of nowhere. And it's that man, Brad Hogg, who scores a direct hit to get him run out. And then comes the next batter, who is not Dravid or Azharuddin or anyone else. It is Jawagal Srinath.
The great pinch hitting experiment of the Titan Cup.
That is one experiment that I couldn't ever get my head wrapped around because I couldn't perhaps figure it out. I think Mark Waugh took me out of my misery, bowled a nice floaty arm ball sort of a off spinner's ball, and it went past the outside edge of the pinch hitter, who you would think is going to smack it around, but he came down the track and tried to defend it. And easy stumpings behind the wicket for Ian Healy. And then came out Mohammad Azharuddin, customary white helmet, unburdened of the load of captaincy. And what an innings did he play. I think it was one of those majorly sparkling innings that he essayed in his ODI career. And the pitch seemed to suit him as well. There was no real pace in the Australian bowling lineup. Perhaps the fastest was Jason Gillespie, who was still a greenhorn. And not too many boundaries, actually. Just a couple of fours and a couple of sixes. But I think the manner in which he stroked the ones and twos was quite a sight. And that partnership between first Sachin and Azhar, and then the Karnataka boy who was already becoming a sight for sore eyes, Rahul Dravid and Mohammad Azharuddin, was quite amazing. And it really felt like we were watching a different Indian team, because they had forgotten to bat like this so fluently for a long time. Again, some of the shot making from Rahul Dravid. I think there's one pull shot that he hits of Jason Gillespie. Goes through mid-wicket and it's almost a front foot pull shot. So good to watch. And yeah, I mean, adrenaline running through the veins big time for me when I was watching all of that.
Nice going for India there. Easy runs for Tendulkar, Azharuddin and Dravid. Setting it up for Robin Singh, who is on his comeback trail after having played a couple of one-dayers for India in 1989. Robin Singh had been consigned to the dustbin, and out of nowhere, like India's tried out maybe 25 players in the series, and Robin Singh was one of them right towards the end. Quite surprising to see Robin Singh come out, maybe because he was a left-hander, much like Ishan Kishan is these days. But Robin Singh comes out, doesn't do too much, gets a boundary out of the way, gets out, and then Jadeja comes in and Nayan Mongia comes in. And India managed to get a few sparkling runs towards the end of this innings.
And India end up with 289, which almost seems unreal now, was the highest score by India in an ODI against Australia. I mean, 289 is not the highest score that you score even in book cricket these days. And back then, yeah, it was like a record.
Well, a few months before this, India had gone past 300 in a one-day game for the very first time.
Yes.
Also, a match that we spoke about, I think, in the very first episode of Heads and Tails. So, yeah, this was distinctly a different era of the one-day game. And I also am not too fond of people comparing eras in one-day cricket for a couple of reasons, which I think we've spoken about too. Nobody really knew what the limits of one-day cricket were back then. It really was seen as an extension of the test format. I think things were just breaking out in the early to mid-90s. But also because the rules of one-day cricket have changed too many times, nobody knows what the power plays are anymore. That's one of the many things that teams are acquainting themselves with before
and
this World
Cup. New white balls and the bouncer law has changed so many times. In fact, in this very match, there is an amazing pull shot that Dravid hits, and the square leg umpire promptly puts his left arm up to signal it as a no ball because it's a bouncer. It's just a regulation bouncer.
Yeah, and in fact, the two new balls is another good point that you mentioned, because the ball in the second half of this chase, the single ball that they use, what we have on YouTube is, of course, fairly grainy Doordarshan standard footage. But even by those standards, the ball is barely visible in the second half of this game because it's completely discolored as it goes towards the latter stages of this match. And we will speak about that. But it is then time for Australia to chase some mammoth score to get into the final. They're a very diffident side, but they still have a fairly good batting lineup, must be said, right? So you have Mark Waugh and Mark Taylor, who was in good form, coming out open, and they get off to a fairly good start, right? Early runs for Australia, a reasonably good opening partnership before the comeback kid, Robin Singh, comes into the attack. With his very first ball, he gets rid of Mark Waugh, bowled, trying to flick a ball in his usual style and missing. And with his next ball, he gets rid of Stuart Law, first ball as well. So India are back in the game after a big opening partnership. And it's then down to Mark Taylor and Steve Waugh, the senior most players in this lineup, to try and make something out of this chase.
Yeah, and they're going quite well at it. I mean, again, doing the regular middle overs thing in ODIs, an out boundary here and there, and ones and twos galore. And then there is an incident that happens. So this is the left arm spinner Sunil Joshi, who comes on to bowl, and Steve Waugh tries to, you know, come down the track with a step or two, not the actual coming down the track to hit a big shot, but it's just to step out and perhaps score a couple of runs somewhere. He hits the ball straight back to Joshi, who sees you know, Steve Waugh out of the crease, and perhaps there is a bit of a prodding or you know, probing by Steve Waugh to see if Sunil Joshi is really going to take a shy at the stumps. He ends up doing that. It misses Steve Waugh. It misses the stumps. It misses Nayan Mongia's attempt to stop it. And it goes for four overthrows. And you can see that when Steve Waugh is trying to come down to the other end to you know, run while the ball goes away to the boundary, there's a bit of a, you know, an exchange that happens between the two. Not sure how much Sunil Joshi really understood the New South Wales accent from Steve Waugh, but there's definitely a bit of a needle. And soon after, the spinner in the best traditions of left arm spin has his revenge, floats up one outside the off stump, perhaps over the eyesight, eye line of Steve Waugh, who comes down the track again. This time it is a big shot that he's attempting. Pitches a little before, a little earlier than what Steve Waugh would have expected, promptly turns away, and Nayan Mungia is safe as a church behind the stumps, and the stumping is completed, and the celebration is boisterous from Sunil Joshi. Not what you would expect from you know, a well-behaved Kannadiga cricketer, but then I think the needle incident over the overthrows had really made him fired up.
There's one thing about Sunil Joshi that I've always wondered. Right. It, when you looked at Sunil Joshi on the field, it seemed like he was carrying the burden of the world on just one of his two shoulders. Have you noticed how Joshi's left shoulder was always at a different altitude than his right shoulder? It seemed like he was born bowling left-arm spin, and he just kept bowling left-arm spin so often that that shoulder, you know, just became that way, right? It was just tilting. The left shoulder is tilting downwards, the right shoulder is up in the air, and if you look at his run-up and his the load-up in the way he runs to the crease, it's exactly with that tilt, right? It's how you become the person that you the world sees you as. Pretty much that, right? Now, Sunil Joshi had more forgettable days as an India cricketer than memorable ones. This moment, where he got rid of Steve Waugh, of course, a very, very memorable moment. A beautiful ball. Reminded me of the ball that Venkatapathy Raju bowled to Rashid Latif in the World Cup a few months before, right? Beating a very good batsman in the air and getting him out stumped.
And then come onto the track Michael Bevan and Michael Slater. Slater, who was, of course, Australia's opener in the test format at that time. And in both formats, he actually batted quite quickly. And both of them set about, you know, doing the unfinished business quite amazingly well. Slater is off the charts straight away. He's stroking boundaries left, right and center, shuffling around the crease in his, you know, very customary way, all elbows and front leg, etc. And, you know, getting quite a few boundaries. And Michael Bevan is the usual ones and twos. Boring sort of ODI batter who, you know, just manages to get his team home at the end. And then again, it's time for a breakthrough. This time it is, who was it? Venkatesh Prasad?
So, Slater, we had never seen Slater bat in the middle order before this. At least I don't remember him doing anything of note in the middle order. And he barely did anything of note in one-day cricket, right? He, for some reason, was one of those players who could not crack one-day cricket, though he had a game which just seemed perfectly set up for the format.
Pretty much in like Virendra Sehwag.
Well, Sehwag did crack one-day cricket. It's only by his own lofty standards of test cricket that you think he underachieved. But He had an average in the early to mid 30s and a strike rate of 90, 9500, I think 100 plus. And that's pretty gutted stats. I think you're being a little unfair to Sehwag if you say he didn't crack one technique. He scored a double 100 in the format, for Christ's sakes. But Slater, you know, showing up in this game, and it's a sign again of how unprepared Australia were for this series, especially the fag end of this tour. I think the wheels were really coming off for Australia. They suddenly have Slater batting the middle order for them. But Slater has this very distinctive look, right? He's very clean-shaven, clean-cut. He's wearing the designer Australian team cap, the baseball-style hood on top of it. He's very clean-shaven. He has this nice, sharp sideburn. Again, a throwback to the late 90s, where this was still in fashion. You don't see anybody with sideburns anymore, do you? And I think maybe we should bring it back into style.
Because everyone has beards.
That is true. That is indeed true. That's a very, very valid point. But even the ones without beards, right, in some of the other teams don't seem to be having sideburns. Maybe we'll have a Maverick who brings back sideburns, cargo pants, bell bottoms, you know, all the nice things from the 90s and 80s. But here was Michael Slater chewing his gum. It is a very, very interesting innings that he plays, right? He scores his 50, I think, of just 34 or 32 balls.
34.
You would imagine for a... And back in those days, 50s of 30-odd balls were very, very rare.
Worth their weight in gold, yeah.
Yeah, unless your name was Sanath Jayasurya, you weren't scoring too many of these. Slater did it. You would imagine that he smashed a lot of boundaries in the process. Barely hit 5 fours. So he's basically not conceded a single dot ball in that innings. He's been taking boundaries and he's been running up and down. And whatever you see in the highlights, you notice that he's coming down the track pretty much every ball, or he's moving, like you mentioned, across the stumps, trying and making them all, you know, play the ball to the leg side. He's trying to score of every single ball. And Australia really are setting up a partnership. And you have Harsha Bogle coming on air at this stage and he's saying, maybe this is where the game is turning, right? And that's just typical Indian commentator trying to suppress the fan in him, which is very disappointed, very anxious about the fact that the game is running away, but also priming the viewers for what could potentially be a very, very disappointing end to the series and to the day. And at that point, our man, Venkatesh Prasad, comes into the attack and delivers a dream leg cutter. A leg cutter that cuts in, goes through the defenses of a left-hand batsman between the bat and the pad. You don't get Michael Bevan bowled too often. But on this day, Prasad managed to bowl the dream delivery and Michael Bevan is gone. The off-bail has gone flying and Bevan's out of there.
Yeah.
Slater is still going great guns.
Yeah.
And Chavagal Srinath played this entire series, got discovered as a pinch hitter, had not taken a single wicket in the series up to this point. This was the first wicket he took in the Titan Cup, and it happened to be Michael Slater, who was otherwise going to win this game for Australia single-handedly. He's once again trying to move across to the offside and tick Srinath away to the leg side, but Srinath manages to get one through, hit him on the pads, and he's out LBW. Srinath's first and only wicket in the Titan Cup. Can you imagine a pace spearhead, probably the first bowler in the team sheet, maybe the second after Kumble, and he only took one wicket in a series which had 7 one-day games. But that's how it was in those days. And Srinath still contributed quite significantly despite not taking wickets, must be said. A few of those lusty blows with the bat, and he was also bowling well all the time, just that the wickets weren't coming. But this was a big one.
And before that also, I mean, Srinath, you know, in his second spell was really in his elements, because there is a very, very close run-out attempt, I think, of
Slater only,
Michael Slater, where, you know, the ball is ball ends up quite near the batter, actually. And Srinath, in his follow-through, goes all the way down to the track, picks up the ball and turns around and hits a direct hit onto the stumps. Of course, Slater is in, but you really feel that, you know, something's going to come up. And then there is the Ian Healy run-out, Tendulkar and Srinath combined to take that wicket. And then there was this wicket, which is, I mean, a pretty straightforward ball, actually. It's just that Michael Slater has become quite used to, you know, moving around the crease, going to the offside to score boundaries as the fine leg is probably up. And one of the balls he misses, it hits him somewhere near the knee roll. And the umpire wastes absolutely no time in raising the finger. And then comes Kumble to, you know, mop up the tail. He did a fantastic job of that time and time again.
Yeah.
I think two bold dismissals, both Jason Gillespie and Paul Rifle are taken out in a jiffy. And
also, so while Kumble comes on to to mop up the tail. You should point out who was at the other end. It was Brad Hawke, once again, batting at number 8, which is the position that all the discussion is around leading up to the 2023 World Cup. Back in 1996, nobody really cared about who was batting for you at number 8. It was most likely a tail-ender. It was most likely a procession of number 11 starting from number 7 itself, right? And it definitely was the case for Australia in this game because they had, like we said, Gillespie, Paul Rifle, and Glenn McGrath, along with Brad Hawke, none of whom really are capable of doing much with the bat. But Brad Hawke is stuck there and they don't have a proper finisher. Kumble comes on, first gets rid of Paul Rifle with a very, very nice googly that goes through. And then he boats the last ball of the 48th over, which is actually Kumble's last over in the match, right? And so he's ready for his last ball. And this is the second thing that I remember from 1996. And it's not actually in the highlights. If you remember, Chops, Kumble takes a good 2 minutes before he bowls that final ball. He stops the play, he asks for a towel, and he spends 2 minutes wiping that ball clean. And you literally are wondering what he's doing. But it's with good reason because the ball is extremely dirty at this point. I'm sure one of the reasons why Australia chose to chase was also, like you mentioned, because of the dew. There was a fair amount of dew that was falling here. Kumble wanted to make sure that last ball, he had a delivery that he could grip and send down. He bowls a beautiful... He actually bowls a fast Yorker. Like, there's no other way to describe it to Jason Gillespie. It seems to swing in as well. But he just wanted the LBW of the bowl. And he knew that he could get it as long as he bowled on target. Gillespie, back in those days, a tall beanpole trying to play the sweep shot. Unsure what he was trying to do. Misses
far
it.
From his 201 days.
Far from his 201 days. Early days of Gillespie's career. That, of course... The 200 against Bangladesh was, of course, right at the end of his career. He never played for Australia after that in Test cricket, sadly. Bold neck and crop trying to sweep the ball, which means Australia are down to their last pair. And they have 2 overs. They don't need too many runs, but they just have 1 more wicket in hand. But it also means India are down to having to bowl a part-timer for the very last over. And the 49th over is bowled by Venkatesh Prasad. Glenn McGrath manages to get a boundary away in that over, which means Australia are in with a shot going into the last over. And who else takes the ball but the captain himself, Sachin Tendulkar, the specialist of the last over.
Perhaps even more in the responsibility era of of his playing career, being the captain and whatnot. And he, in fact, bowls a pretty good first ball. It's right near the block hole, if not in the block hole exactly. And it's Brad Hawke facing who... tries to hit a big shot towards the leg side, misses the ball. It hits his shoe or his pad or something and goes towards the wicketkeeper. And Glenn McGrath has already set off, perhaps a candidate for the Mankad dismissal, but we don't have replays good enough or arrows of Peter Della Penna to show us what would have happened had Tendulkar gone for it. But McGrath is really off, in a flash. And by the time Mongia gets to the ball, he's perhaps almost into the crease or into the crease completely.
Well in.
And Mongia realizes that. Mongia was another cool, calm cucumber behind the stumps. He realizes that and sees that Brad Hawke is nowhere near his crease. And thankfully, the Indians, unlike their neighbors, Pakistan, in moments of such runouts, they manage to keep their calm. Everyone manages to keep away from the track. Mongia throws it right back to Sachin, who manages to get the ball. It's a direct hit.
Yeah, it's a direct hit. So you've got to give Mongia a lot of credit for what he does here, right? Nobody notices this. And in fact, I myself did not until I saw the replay today. So it's, like you mentioned, a great ball, right? And Brad Hawke, deer in the floodlights, deer in the 11 or 12 towers of floodlights, must be said. Goes for the sweep shot. Ball hits the top flap of the pad and flies high. Like you said, McGrath has taken off. The ball goes behind. Mongia, as he runs towards the ball, gets rid of his right glove, right? Which is not something keepers generally do. He was already alert to the fact that he's not going to be able to run out McGrath at the batsman's end and the run out opportunity is going to be at the bowler's end. Coolly picks up the ball, throws it down. Tendulkar does very well to get out of the way and let the ball go and hit the stumps. And that's the end of Brad Hawke. That's the end of the match. Right? It is, I think, one of the coolest dismissals. It's a throwback or a throw forward, I don't know how you term it, to what MS Dhoni did against Bangladesh in the 2016 World T20. Of course, Dhoni removed the glove even before the ball was bowled. But I think to keep his wits about himself and to remove that glove as he was going.
Yeah.
India are going into this World Cup chops with two part-time wicketkeepers, right? KL Rahul and Ishan Kishan. I don't know if either of them would have the presence of mind to do what Mungia did on that day. Right.
Absolutely.
One of the many things that India need to think about going into this World Cup. Number eight, not a great idea to have a bunny rabbit, as proven by Brad Hogg, but you might want a specialist wicketkeeper in there.
Yeah, and the other thing I remember about the end of this match is how Megra, who had already scored a boundary, so maybe he thought that, you know, if I've scored a boundary, Australia is bound to win, like that's written in the stars or something. But he stands so dejected at the batting end. Completely forlorn, and somehow it reminded me in a nice throw forward to what happened to Alan Donald in the 1999 World Cup, where that famous ODI, perhaps the best ODI ever played.
Which we have spoken about on our podcast.
Yes, we have. The 1999 semi-final, and somehow if you put them, you know, side by side as broadcasters used to do back then, it would perhaps, you know, paint a very similar image, the premier pacer of the team having to come out right at the end to secure an unlikely win for their team and not managing to do that and getting run out. So very, very sad scenes for Glenn Megra and for Australia. But the jubilation on the Indians' face is writ large. Very, very happy to go to Wankhede for the final. And there also, they managed to eke out a win and give Tendulkar, you know, the chance to lift the Titan Cup. The other nice thing that we mentioned in the earlier episode also that we did on the Titan Cup was the fact that as man of the match, you got a nice watch. And this time, the man of the match was Azharuddin, who was
a collector of watches. Indeed.
Very, very, very fond of watches. And I mean, first thing he says in the presentation ceremony is, yeah, very fond of watches.
Very, very happy to have another watch. Yes. Have you ever worn a Titan watch, Chops?
I have, of course. I mean, it's almost, you know, part of growing up in India that you have a Titan watch. And I think all of us have had one at some stage of our lives.
If you've liked listening to this episode, do give a listen to our earlier episodes as well. We love going back to 96 and to the Titan Cup. So you will find India versus Australia and Bangalore also in our archives. Do tell your friends about this podcast. The more people listen to us, the more people get to discover us. And that's always good for people doing podcasts. So thank you for your patronage.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You were listening to Heads and Tails, hosted by Abhishek Chopra and Nitin Sundar. Produced by Audiomatic. Producers for Audiomatic, Rajesh Tahil and Avdhoot Khanolkar. Assistant producer, Pia Kash.